before I begin, I also want to thank a few people, especially thank James O'Brien, who organized this event. He invited me to participate, and he got the funding for this event. He wrote a lot of grants and just did a tremendous amount of work. So let's give James a quick hand. And I also want to thank the Chautauqua County Historical Society for keeping the Tourjet papers accessible over all of these years. Without their support and their assistance, I certainly could have never written my book on Albion Tourjet. And finally, I want to thank the Robert H. Jackson Center for letting us use this beautiful facility today for this event. Since the Jackson Center is the host of the event, I thought that I would begin my talk with a letter from Robert H. Jackson. On April the 4th, 1950, the Supreme Court Justice wrote a letter to some of his friends in Jamestown, New York. Jackson had recently discovered an impressively argued legal brief by one Albion W. Tourjet, filed among the papers in the 1896 U.S. Supreme Court case of Plessy v. Ferguson. Jackson knew it had to be the same Albion Tourjet he recalled hearing about in his youth, though he'd never met him. This was a once famous author who lived in nearby Mayville. He knew this because Tourjet's career had been built upon the forceful advocacy of black civil rights and the vigorous defense of the racial egalitarian ideals of Reconstruction, two characteristics of the brief he had discovered. But more than this, Jackson knew it because could there really be two men named Albion Tourjet? And in all of my studies, I can say I only found one other Albion Tourjet. It was Albion Tourjet Woods, who was in fact named after Albion Tourjet. So. Now, Jackson was mystified as to how this upstate New Yorker came to be involved in a case arising out of New Orleans. And he wondered why Tourjet's participation and his powerful arguments in the case were not as well known to locals as Tourjet's best-selling novels. Curious about how Tourjet got into the case, Jackson marveled at his far-sighted arguments. Quote, "There's no argument made today that he would not make to the court," Jackson observed, adding, "His brief is a rather witty production of points." In particular, Jackson took notice of Tourjet's assertion that, quote, "the law ought to at least be colorblind." And he remarked, "Whether this was original wit with him, it has been gotten off a number of times since as original wit." Jackson's investigation into the Plessy case came not out of idle curiosity. On the very date of Jackson's letter, April the 4th, 1850, two cases were argued before the Supreme Court that once again challenged the constitutionality of racial segregation. These were the cases of Sweat versus Painter and McLaurin versus Oklahoma Board of Regents. Each involved segregated schools. Each offered the court with an opportunity to reverse the infamous precedent of Plessy v. Ferguson that had established the famous separate but equal doctrine that was used by the state of Louisiana to justify legally required racial segregation. That was the legal foundation of the Jim Crow South, and it was built upon the Plessy decision. As Jackson wrote to his friends, he pondered whether or not he would vote to reverse Plessy, and remarked that it still remained to be seen whether Tourjet's position would be adopted and, quote, "what was a defeat for him in 96 will be a post-mortem victory." Tourjet's post-mortem victory would have to wait four more years. In 1950, Jackson and a majority of his colleagues on the Supreme Court chose not to directly attack the precedent of Plessy v. Ferguson, but rather to vote in favor of the plaintiffs in the two above-mentioned cases on narrower grounds. Instead, it would be Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka in 1954 that dealt the death blow to Plessy. In that landmark case, a unanimous court that included a physically ailing Justice Jackson and a brand new Chief Justice, Earl Warren, ruled that segregating schools by race is, quote, inherently unequal, unquote, and declared, quote, "any language in Plessy v. Ferguson contrary to this finding is rejected." Though its legal standing is no more, the Plessy case should not and cannot be erased from history. Over a half century since the momentous Brown decision, the same debate over the proper remedies for racial injustice and protections of equal citizenship that Tourget helped to initiate in the 19th century remain unsettled. There is much to learn from revisiting Tourget's early struggles for civil rights, and it is true, just as Justice Jackson remarked in 1950, there are few arguments made today that Tourget did not make himself back in 1896. Indeed, Tourget's brief in the Plessy case has recently been rediscovered by a new generation of legal and historical scholars, and its arguments have become the subject of rapidly increasing attention in law reviews and scholarly journals over the past decade. His arguments that the law should be colorblind, for one, has drawn attention from scholars who recognize his use of this concept as one of the first influential articulations of a constitutional position on race-neutral citizenship. At the same time, Tourget made pioneering arguments about the nature of white privilege, in particular his assertion that whiteness functions as a kind of property in America that inherently advantages some while disadvantaging others. The assertion that whiteness is property has been more recently a main contention of legal scholars who reject the possibility of race-neutral citizenship in a society with deeply entrenched institutional and cultural racism. In his elaboration on these points and others, Tourget may still have more to contribute to our contemporary debates on the relation of race and citizenship. But today, I want to begin with a more simple question before maybe returning to those themes. Who was Albion Tourget? It's also still true today what Jackson said back in 1950, that people don't know Tourget or about Tourget or his involvement in the case or his work beyond his novels. His list of distinctions is long, and in fact, the case of Plessy v. Ferguson came at the end of a remarkable career. A few things that he accomplishments and distinctions of his I'm going to list for you. He was a Union officer. He served in two enlistments in the Civil War. He served an 8-year term as U.S. Superior Court Justice in North Carolina from 1868 to 1874. 6-year term. Co-author of the North Carolina Legal Codes. A main architect of North Carolina's 1868 state constitution. He achieved national literary fame as the author of more than 20 books, including 2 bestsellers. He was the editor of a national monthly magazine entitled Our Continent. He was a popular columnist for nearly a decade for the Chicago Daily Inner Ocean, which then was one of the leading newspapers of Chicago. He was an honorary professor of legal ethics at Buffalo Law School, founder of the first national citizens' rights organization called the National Citizens' Rights Association in 1891. He was the lead counselor for the plaintiff in Plessy v. Ferguson. And finally, he was the author of the nation's first anti-lynching law passed in the state of Ohio in 1896. And that's an incomplete list, but it gives you a sense of the scope of his career. His career spanned one of the most tumultuous periods in American history that saw the nation torn apart by civil war, slavery abolished, the former slave states reformed and reconstructed, partially, the United States Constitution revised in fundamental ways. Tourget took an active part in all of these changes, yet he lived to witness a counter-revolution succeed that attempted to undo all that had been accomplished. In the final years of his life, Tourget did everything in his power to halt this counter-revolution. What made Tourget most unusual, I think, was that he retained the core values of his youth in the antebellum Midwest in an age that had become disillusioned with the moral politics of the abolitionist movement. So let me tell you a little bit about his upbringing. He was actually from Northeast Ohio, in a region that was known then as the Western Reserve. He was born on May 2nd, 1838, and he was the child of New England migrants who had just recently arrived from Massachusetts to a land that was really still the frontier in 1838. During Tourget's youth, the demographic profile and culture of the Western Reserve mirrored that of Western New York. Both were burned over districts where religious enthusiasm of evangelical revivals paved the road for a plethora of radical and utopian political movements. Among the most controversial of these evangelical influenced movements was abolitionism. Though he never embraced the immediatism of the most uncompromising abolitionists in his youth. I mean, he was still a teenager in the 1850s. Tourget did lament the crying sin of slavery as a young man, and he was impressed by the courage of hardliners who endured public ridicule and often risked their lives in their unrelenting agitation for the abolition of slavery. Later in life, he would write glowingly of abolitionists like Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison, who, in his mind, were men of conscience, who refused to allow their fellow citizens to shut their eyes to this great injustice. He credited the abolitionists with hastening a transformation of public values that eventually brought down the slave empire, an event deemed impossible by many when the abolitionist movement began. Tourget attended the University of Rochester, but he dropped out in his sophomore year to enlist in the Union Army. He actually responded to Lincoln's very first call for troops in April of 1861. Whenever he discussed his personal history, Tourget would insist that it was the war, the Civil War and his experience there, that radicalized him on racial issues. As a soldier, he witnessed slavery for the first time, and along with others of his regiment, fought and forged an alliance with fugitive slaves who entered their lines and refused to surrender them to local authorities. These experiences brought about a new conviction that the war had been intended to serve a higher purpose. When Lincoln implemented the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, Tourget wrote to his fraternity brothers at the University of Rochester, urging them to enlist. And this is one of the great letters that exists in the Tourget collection. Tourget told them, quote, I don't care a rag for the Union as it was, the slogan of the Union, of the Lincoln administration up until the point of emancipation. I want and I fight for the Union better than it was. Before this is accomplished, we must have a thorough and complete revolution and renovation. This I expect and hope. For this, I am willing to die. For this, I expect to die. Inspiring as this was, there's no evidence that any of his brothers from Rochester were immediately off to enlist to fight. Perhaps the reference to dying was off-putting a little bit. He participated in several significant engagements with the enemy at the First Bull Run, Perryville, Stones River, Chattanooga, and Chickamauga. And he suffered paralyzing injuries that forced him to resign his commission finally in 1863, and that plagued him for the rest of his life. On a furlough in May of 1863, Tourget married his longtime fiancée, Emma Kilbourne, who had been a classmate at the Kingsville Academy in Ohio, Kingsville, Ohio. When he resigned his commission, he returned to Ohio. He passed the bar exam, and he wanted to be a practicing lawyer, but he found opportunities too few. They briefly moved to Erie, Pennsylvania, and then Tourget hatched a bold plan. He convinced Emma and her family and some of his friends from Rochester to join him in relocating to the South. He personally organized this caravan of friends and family and brought them to Greensboro, North Carolina, where he had arranged to purchase property from a prominent Quaker family. The South as a whole presented an inviting field of opportunity for those with capital and skills to invest. But once in Greensboro, the Tourgets demonstrated that they had interests other than mercenary ones. Did I give you the date? That was in the spring of 1865. Both Albion and Emma became actively involved with the local Quaker community, who were longtime anti-slavery agitators, and they joined them in aiding the black community, founding schools, and facilitating the purchase of property for former slaves. This work came under attack when North Carolina conservatives swept into power in 1866 and proceeded to immediately pass a series of laws curtailing the civil rights of all black people. Tourget's eloquent denunciation of these repressive black codes at local political meetings catapulted him into a position of leadership, and soon he was editing a Republican newspaper. And he was chosen to represent Guilford County at the National Loyalist Convention held in Philadelphia in 1866 to help organize a Republican Party in the South. In 1868, he was elected to North Carolina's Constitutional Convention on the strength of the black electorate, who had been temporarily temporarily at that point, enfranchised by the U.S. Congress, who had taken control of Reconstruction away from President Andrew Johnson. Tourjée's legal training and oratorical prowess made him a natural leader at the Constitutional Convention, where he helped secure broad reforms, including equal citizenship for all men, regardless of race, elimination of property requirements for jury duty and the holding of public office, abolition of corporal punishment, including whips and stocks, guaranteed free public education for all, which was a tremendously radical proposition at that time, popular election of most political offices and judgeships, and an overhaul to the civil and criminal codes. Though he failed to secure two additional reforms, the elimination of poll taxes and the abolition of capital punishment, the new constitution amounted to an egalitarian revolution in the state that would never entirely be reversed, even after the fall of the Republican governments in the South. After the constitution was ratified, Tourjée served on a three-person committee to rewrite the codes of civil procedure for the state, eliminating antiquated procedures that bogged down the justice system, and he modernized the law to make it more comprehensible and accessible to the public. After the convention, Tourjée was elected a Superior Court Justice, one of the few qualified Republican candidates with legal training. His proficiency in the law served him well during his term from 1868 to 1874. He distinguished himself in the courtroom and earned the respect and praise of many, including some prominent conservatives. This is not to say that his jurisprudence was uncontroversial, however. Far from it, his courtroom was notorious for such unusual policies as a ban on the use of racial epithets by practicing lawyers on the penalty of a stiff fine, and also an insistence on racially integrated juries in cases that involved racial violence. On several occasions, he put his own life in jeopardy by implementing harsh sentences for white men, for crimes against blacks, and for taking steps to make certain justice was served in the courtroom, regardless of public pressure to acquit. A campaign of terror and vilification against Republican government spread in 1868-1870. Oh, yes, this is Tourjée during the Civil War years. And here's Tourjée as a judge in the 1870s. I'm going to show you a few images, but these images are also, the originals are in the exhibit just in the room outside, so I hope you do go and take a look at these and other great images that they brought together for this event today. A campaign of terror and vilification undertaken by that shadowy organization that called itself the Ku Klux Klan. Tourjée personally found himself the target of threats and assassination plots. Some of those threatening letters are in our exhibit. You can see the actual letters he received. It was rumored that he had been sentenced to death by the Klan. Not one to back down to extra-legal politics, he personally led an investigation that brought indictments against 63 Klan members and ensnared several prominent citizens. He managed to avoid assassination, although some of his Republican colleagues were not as lucky. And in the South, Tourjée survived. He lived a very isolated and unconventional life, however. The Tourjées were shunned by Southern polite society because of their close association with blacks and with Northern school teachers and missionaries who worked with blacks, and finally also with lower class whites. That was their social world. In 1869, the Tourjées adopted Adeline Petillo, who was a destitute ex-slave, and raised her and her sister Mary in their home to the great horror of the conservative press. Adeline is on your right and her younger sister Mary on the left. Adeline, by the way, she eventually married a man named Frank Woods in 1878, and she named one of her sons, Alvion Tourjée Woods, who I mentioned earlier. In 1873, they sent Adeline to Virginia's Hampton Institute, where she was a classmate of Booker T. Washington, and then on to other boarding schools in the South. And you can see that they tried to give her the life of Northern middle class comforts and respectability, quote unquote. After the birth of a daughter in 1870, however, Emma Tourjet's enthusiasm for their work in North Carolina began to fade. And here's Emma and their daughter, Amy, who actually usually went by the nickname Lodi. Amy was their only natural child, and Emma felt she needed to be raised in a less hostile environment where they could freely attend church, something they couldn't do in Greensboro. And she feared the treatment that her daughter was going to receive when she entered school. After several extended stays with her sister in Erie, Pennsylvania, Emma decided to take Amy to Erie permanently, and she separated from Albion in 1878. A year later, Albion made a failed run for U.S. Congress from Greensboro, and then finally decided to reconcile with Emma and leave North Carolina for good. In 1879, Tourjet turned his experiences during Reconstruction into a novel. The final withdrawal of federal support for Republican governments in South Carolina and Louisiana overwhelmed him with an urge to tell the true story of Reconstruction, to counter the lies and propaganda. The result was a novel anonymously published in November of 1879 entitled A Fool's Errand by One of the Fools. Within 6 weeks of its release, A Fool's Errand became a sensational bestseller, enjoying dozens of rave reviews and attracting a great deal of speculation about the identity of the author. Some thought the author was Harriet Beecher Stowe. The novel seemed to stir the old anti-slavery fervor in the North. Just like Uncle Tom's Cabin, it dramatized a political message, a message about racial equality. And it sparked a genuine political debate over the need for new approaches to solving the racial strife in the South. Most gratifying to Tourjet was the unexpectedly warm reception for his vindication of the much-abused carpetbaggers, of which, of course, he was classed, scalawags, and freedmen, who were depicted in his novel as courageous defenders of democracy and the rule of law, standing alone against unreconstructed Confederates who sought to undo the results of the Civil War. The story concluded with an endorsement of federal funding for public education in the South and continued federal protection of black civil rights. Once his authorship had been revealed, Tourjet took up residence in New York City, where he enjoyed celebrity status and rubbed elbows with leading literary figures and Republican Party string pullers. He was embraced as an important voice for the stalwart faction of the Republican Party, and he took an active role in the presidential campaign of 1880, wielding a direct influence on the Republican candidate, James A. Garfield, who happened to be a childhood friend of his from Ohio. Garfield consulted him on Southern issues and told him that he was going to be his main advisor, or that he needed him as a main advisor on the South. During this campaign, Tourjet authored a second novel about the South, Bricks Without Straw, which came out during the election season and even surpassed the original in its sales during its first 6 months. It concluded with another plea for federal intervention in the South. After Garfield was elected president, unfortunately, Tourjet's hopes were dashed when he was assassinated just a few months into his first term. Tourjet's position of influence in the Republican Party quickly faded, and he gave up his designs for a patronage position in the Garfield administration, and turning instead to his literary career. It was in 1881, on a trip through western New York, that Tourjet purchased the 23-room mansion situated on Lake Chautauqua in the town of Mayville. Whimsically, he dubbed this home Thorheim, or Fool's Home. And by the way, his home in Greensboro he had dubbed Carpetback Lodge. So, a perfect writer's retreat, this home was located close to the thriving intellectual community at the Chautauqua Institution, where Tourjet would become a regular speaker in the years ahead. And he was within reach of many friends and family in Erie and the Western Reserve. The house still stands, as you may know, with the historical site marker over there on South Erie Street, I believe. He continued to write fiction while living in Mayville, and he eventually produced a total of 12 novels, 3 novellas, and 3 collections of short stories. And that's just his fiction. He also has an incredible list of nonfiction, mostly in the form of essays, articles, newspapers, columns. When he was not writing, Tourget went on lecture tours. And in 1888, he began writing a weekly column for the leading Republican newspaper of Chicago, the Daily Interocean. This column brought him back into the thick of politics. He concentrated his attacks on the Republican Party, had a fairly complicated relationship with this Republican newspaper. They're always telling him, direct your venom at the Democrats, not at us. But he kept turning his fire on Republican leaders. But most importantly, he protested against a new wave of white supremacy in the South. His column carried gruesome details of alarming number of incidents involving racial violence and brutal lynching. Lynching was a growing phenomenon. And these incidents had failed to receive any attention in the Northern press, something he was quick to remind his readers time and time again. His columns provoked extreme responses, an avalanche of hate mail from those who accused Tourget of dredging up Civil War antagonisms for political purposes. He also received letters from scores of admirers, especially from African Americans who cheered his unwavering devotion to principle. A bystander's notes was soon being republished across the nation in black-owned newspapers, bringing Tourget renewed status and visibility, especially in the black community. When the state of Louisiana passed the Separate Car Act of 1890, requiring railroads to maintain separate, actually, as they phrased it, equal but separate facilities for blacks and whites, Tourget denounced it in his column. He called on New Orleans citizens to protest this law, and he suggested that it was unconstitutional. This law was, in fact, one of the bold new attempts by conservative governments in the South to deprive blacks of civil and political rights, the same rights they had gained during Reconstruction, not just through intimidation and violence and extra-legal measures, but now through legislation. Though segregation was already widely practiced in privately owned business and tolerated in public schools, which were local community controlled, no states had actually passed laws that required racial segregation and penalized citizens for not segregating. And Tourget, they didn't do so because they believed it violated the 14th Amendment. Tourget certainly agreed. He called upon Louisiana blacks to challenge constitutionality of the law, citing the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection of the laws and its clear language that, quote, no state may make or enforce any law that deprived American citizens of their privileges or immunities. Within a year, a group of local activists in New Orleans, led by Louis Martinet, editor of an African-American newspaper, the New Orleans Crusader, and he was an avid reader of bystander's notes, he organized a Citizens League to challenge the law. When he had raised $1,400, Martinet contacted Tourget and offered him the entire fund to be lead counsel in the case from beginning to end. Though he was heavily in debt, Tourget agreed to take the case without remuneration. The fund was used instead to hire co-counselors with more experience in the procedures of Louisiana and co-counselors in Washington to help guide the case to the Supreme Court. Through long-distance correspondence, Tourget worked with his colleagues on every detail of their test case, from the choice of defendant and the staging of the arrest to the fine points of argument to be made at the local, state, and federal levels. From the beginning, Tourget and Martinet saw the Louisiana test case as only one prong in a larger strategy to stop the assault on black civil rights. With their collective experience in journalism, they agreed to launch a national civil rights organization and publish their activities as widely as possible. Tourget announced in a bystander's notes in a column on October the 17th, 1891, the founding of a new organization to protect the rights of all citizens regardless of color. And he declared their intent to discover, quote, whether justice is still colorblind or national citizenship worth a rag for the defense of right. The National Citizens' Rights Organization enlisted 20,000 members by some estimates by the end of 1891, and planning began for a journal to be called The National Citizen. And another treasure of the Tourget papers here are the letters and subscriptions that the National Civil Rights Organization received They're collected in a large pile of letters, not only requests for subscriptions, but also descriptions of some of the injustices people were suffering. Sometimes these letters are written in barely literate, by people who are barely literate in poor, impoverished regions of the South, describing incidents and events that are going on. And as far as I know, few scholars have ever used that resource. Under the auspices of the NCRA, Tourjée met with political leaders. He published pamphlets and editorials, and he lectured extensively for the following 3 years. In 1894, Harry Smith, African-American editor of the Cleveland Gazette, enlisted the NCRA's support in his campaign to draft an anti-lynching law in the state of Ohio. Tourjée drew up a law that would penalize any county that had an incident of a mob lynching with a steep fiscal penalty, in the theory that lynchings usually occurred with the tacit approval of communities and law enforcement. Therefore, by punishing the community, mobs would be prevented before they happened. He wanted a $10,000 fine to be levied as a tax. The law was eventually passed after Harry Smith was elected to the State House of Representatives in 1896, and he introduced what he called the Tourjée Bill. When it was enacted into law, $5,000 was the fine that they finally came up with. This law was upheld twice by the Ohio State Supreme Court, and it was the first of its kind in the country and widely regarded in Ohio as a success. Meanwhile, it took 5 years from the inception of the Louisiana test case to make it to the Supreme Court. After one false start, in which Tourjée actually won his case on technical grounds, a second test case began when Homer Adolph Plessy boarded a train in New Orleans, in a New Orleans station, in a car reserved for whites only. This was June 7, 1892. An activist and local shoemaker, Plessy was approached by the Citizens Committee to serve as the plaintiff to satisfy Tourjée's request that a man light-skinned enough to pass for white ought to serve in the role. Tourjée was to all appearances a white man because 7 of his 8 grandparents were of white ancestry. Indeed, when his arrest took place, Plessy had to reveal his racial identity to the conductor in order for authorities to arrest him for unlawfully sitting in a white-only car. Tourjée hoped that Plessy's ambiguous racial identity and deceptive appearance would raise a legal quagmire over how to define race in the first place, something that the Louisiana statute book had never attempted to do. How could a railroad company be held liable, and they were fined if they did not follow the requirements of the law, for making public racial assessments when the state of Louisiana could provide no guidance or clear-cut definition of race, especially based on appearance alone? You don't have time to look into people's documents and genealogy. Tourjée anticipated the Louisiana Criminals Court ruling by Judge John H. Ferguson convicting Plessy of violating the Separate Car Act. And Tourjée's appeal of Ferguson's decision made its way to the Louisiana State Supreme Court as Plessy v. Ferguson. By December 1892, the Louisiana Supreme Court upheld Ferguson's ruling, and Tourjée's appeal awaited hearing the nation's highest court. 3.5 long years later, the United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments on April 13, 1896. Tourjée and his co-counsel, Samuel F. Phillips, I have a few more images here. Whoops. There's the Supreme Court in 1896. We're present in the old Senate chamber of the U.S. Capitol building where they held the Supreme Court held its court to argue the case. The arguments made in the Plessy case have often been misunderstood. One reason is that the Separate Car Act itself prohibited the inferior conditions that often existed on black-only cars. The law attempted to satisfy the requirements of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause by providing that separate coaches for blacks and whites must be kept substantially equal in quality, right? Separate but equal. To argue that the equality requirement was often neglected would do nothing to challenge the law. That was the law. Tourjée's burden was to demonstrate that its intent was to degrade and subordinate non-whites. As he put it to the court, "The statute itself is a skillful attempt to confuse and conceal its real purpose. It assumes impartiality. It fulminates apparently against white and black alike. Its real object is to keep Negroes out of one car for the gratifications of whites, not to keep whites out of another car for the comfort and satisfaction of the colored passenger." To persuade the court of this fact, in particular, those hostile justices, which included at least one former Ku Klux Klan member, who were inclined to look beyond the letter of the law, would require some innovative argumentation. Turgay pursued too many lines of argument to summarize today in this brief review. However, among those, one of the most notable was his assertion that the state did not have the power to, quote, know the race, unquote, of its citizens. All were equal before the law. Justice was pictured blind, and her daughter, the law, ought to at least be colorblind. And I skipped over that slide. Let me go back to it. Oops. Oh, sorry. Hold on just a second here. Now I've got it. Yeah. But Turgay went further than simply to assert that race should not matter. He argued that race itself was a category that had no stable or central meaning. He showed that its definitions changed from state to state, from nation to nation, and that Louisiana had failed to provide any definition of race at all. Race is a question, he told the court, which the law of Louisiana has not decided and which science itself is totally unable to solve. On which side of the color line did a man like Homer Plessy belong? Or as Turgay put it, who are white and who are colored? Anticipating the modern view that notions of race are mere social customs and not biological fact, he dismissed the idea that the state had any right to, quote, label one citizen white and another colored when these were arbitrary classifications. Turgay also used the racial indeterminacy of Homer Plessy to argue that whiteness functioned as a form of property in the United States. What would happen, he conjectured, if a white man were misidentified as black by a railroad conductor? That man's reputation might be damaged so completely that he ought to sue the railroad company. To be forced to submit to haphazard public assessments of one's race, he argued, risked damage to the value of one's whiteness. Using this point as an opening, Turgay then discoursed memorably about the social power of whiteness, which is the second quote I've given you. How much would it be worth to a young man entering upon the practice of law to be regarded as a white man rather than a colored one? 6/7 of our population are white. 19/20 of the property of the country is owned by white people. 99/100 of the business opportunities are in the control of white people. These propositions are rendered even more startling by the intensity of feeling that excludes the colored man from the friendship and companionship of the white man. Under these conditions, is it possible to conclude that the reputation of being white is not property? Indeed, is it not the most valuable sort of property, being the master key that unlocks the golden door of opportunity? This is a powerful philosophical insight. Turgay's argument about whiteness also directed the court's attention to the real social world in which racial segregation existed. The sole purpose of segregation, it was clear, was to stigmatize blacks and perpetuate the supremacy of a ruling class that was based on whiteness. Separate could never be equal in that world. Of course, Turgay's arguments did not prevail. The Supreme Court ruled 8-1 to uphold Justice Ferguson's decision and determined that the Separate Car Act met the 14th Amendment's guarantees of equal protection and due process. Only Justice John Marshall Harlan from Kentucky dissented, and he echoed Turgay in his famous dissent. I believe I have that up here. Oh, maybe I don't. Oh, I thought I had Harlan. Hold on. I'm afraid not. Sorry, just have the Supreme Court today. Harlan's famous dissent declares, our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. One of the many times, as Jackson said, this phrase was borrowed and passed off as original wit. Tarlin's dissent was cold comfort for Tourget, who predicted that this decision would cost the nation another civil war to undo the results. Now, Tourget, after the Plessy decision, he ended his civil rights work. This was a crushing, crushing result. By the time Plessy had reached the Supreme Court, the NCRA itself had become all but defunct. The reactionary spirit of the 1890s overwhelmed its efforts to halt Jim Crow through protest and political pressure, and a new strategy, dubbed accommodationism to segregation, had arisen in speeches of black leaders like Booker T. Washington, who was just the most well-known of them, that captured the attention of the press. Many believed that violence and lynching would subside once troublemakers like Tourget and his sympathizers would quit their agitation on the so-called race problem. The press spin on this at the time was that it's the Tourgets that are making all of this terrible things happen. From this perspective, the doctrine of separate but equal promised a peaceful resolution to racial strife, in which blacks and whites could coexist with a minimum of antagonism and interaction. A great many hard-won rights, however, were sacrificed in the bargain. Tourget reluctantly silenced his pen on the struggle that absorbed most of his career. After campaigning for William McKinley in 1896, he was rewarded with a foreign ambassadorship as United States Consul to Bordeaux, France. In 1897, Tourget left Mayville for France, never to return to the United States. He spent the last 8 years of his life reflecting upon the future of democracy around the world and observing painfully as the promise of Washington's accommodationism failed to stem the tide of violence and lynching in America. He died May 21st, 1905. Emma Tourget brought his cremated remains back to the United States and had them interred at the Mayville Cemetery, where a stately monument to his memory now stands. Emma herself lived at Thorheim until her death in 1915, when she bequeathed a portion of her property to the Tuesday Club, which then evolved into Mayville's first public library, and stands on that site today. In July of 1905, a few months after his death, a new civil rights organization was founded, which would carry on Tourget's legacy. The Niagara Movement, launched by W.E.B. Du Bois, William Trotter, and Harry C. Smith, Tourget's old friend, and many others, represented a break with the accommodationist leaders and took inspiration from the work of Tourget and activists before him. In 1910, their movement would reorganize itself as the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, which of course brought the cases to the Supreme Court in the 1950s that I began this talk by referencing. And their work would lead to the reversal of Plessy v. Ferguson. At the inaugural meeting in 1905 of the Niagara Movement, they adopted a resolution that each local chapter should hold memorial services that Thanksgiving to honor three friends of freedom whose uncompromising approach to justice they aspired to emulate. And these three men they identified were William Lloyd Garrison, Frederick Douglass, and Albion Tourget. Now, Tourget's fame has never equaled that of Garrison or Douglass in the history books. No doubt both of those men had a larger impact on their times, but they also enjoyed an immortalized success through the abolition of slavery, the single greatest object of their public crusade. Tourget enjoyed no lasting triumph. The history of Reconstruction was buried under a mountain of myth and propaganda that vilified carpetbaggers like Tourget and depicted the period as a shameful episode of sectional animosity rather than a high-minded egalitarian revolution on behalf of democracy, as Tourget saw it. The Plessy case, too, has been shrouded in myth and until recently studied mostly as an example of racist jurisprudence. But the rediscovery of Tourget's role in the case, which has been prompted somewhat by the 100th anniversary in 1996, there's been an outpouring of scholarly research into the case since then. It has added to Tourget's growing reputation and the growing recognition of his argument's relevance for our own political debates today. I think all of this promises to give this deserving civil rights champion his due place in history at long last, And I think this event here today also inspires me with hope that Tourget's name might be restored to the history books sometime soon. Thank you very much.